cheese and... Then what? Go to see Mr. Trezick, she supposed, to explain the whole situation. But beneath those thoughts were layered other, more disturbing ones. For behind all this lay one simple, immutable fact. Maud was still missing, and no one seemed to know what had happened to her. Sometime after February 1995, she had slipped out of sight of her mother, brothers, and cousin, and disappeared. Had she gone of her own volition? Or was the truth something else, something more sinister? Hal thought of her as she walked, of the fiercely intelligent child that both Lizzie and Mr. Trezick remembered with such amused awe. Of the girl in Maggie's diaries who had fought with Mrs. Westaway and guarded Maggie's secrets. And of the woman she had wanted to become, free, educated, independent. Had she made it? Was that the truth? That she had helped her cousin free herself from Trepassen House and then disappeared in her own turn to make her life somewhere else? It was possible, but it seemed so unlikely and so strange that in all the years Hal's mother had never even mentioned her name. However much Maggie had wanted to leave the unhappiness of Trepassen behind her, it seemed unbelievably callous to have erased the existence of a woman who had done so much to help her. But the only other possibility was even more disturbing. That Margarita Westaway was dead. Chapter 37. Hal was soaked and shivering by the time she got to the big wrought iron gates. She was profoundly grateful that Abel had made her take his walking jacket, but the hood was too big to stay up. However tight she pulled the drawstring, the wind blew it back and sent the rain running down the back of her neck to soak her t-shirt. For a mile or so she tried holding it in place with one hand, but even with her fingers scrunched as far as she could get into the cuffs of the coat, it left her hands cold and blue. And in the end she abandoned the hood and shoved her hands deep into the pockets of the coat. When Hal pushed open the gates, the hinges shrieked, a low, mournful sound that cut through the patter of the rain and made her shiver in a way that wasn't just cold. There was something about the long, low note that made the skin on the back of Hal's neck crawl. It was as though the house itself were dying in pain. By the time she got up to the house, there was a little sleet mixed in with the rain, the tiny shards of ice stinging her cheek and making her eyes water, and in spite of her trepidation, she was glad to reach the shelter of the porch, where the wind dropped, and she could shake off the worst of the water. Inside, she took off Abel's coat, watching as the water pooled on the tiles, and feeling the sensation painfully returning to her chapped fingers, stinging as the blood began to return. From the drawing room she could hear male voices, and, taking a deep breath, she put the coat on the peg and made her way across the hallway to the half-open door.
"Hal?"
Abel looked around as Hal entered diffidently.
"Bloody hell! You look like a drowned rat! Why didn't you call me?"
"I was enjoying the walk," Hal said. She moved closer to the fire, trying to mask the chattering of her teeth. It was not quite a lie. She had not enjoyed the walk, not exactly, but she had not wanted a lift. She needed the time to clear her head, work out what she was going to say. Across the room, Ezra was sprawled on the sofa, replying to something on his phone, but he looked up as Hal passed him and gave a snorting laugh.
"I've never seen anyone look quite so impressively bedraggled. I'm afraid you've missed lunch, but we could probably brave Mrs. Warren's lair for a cup of tea if you need something to warm you up. All the water in the immersion tank should be hot, if you want a bath."
"I'll do that," Hal said, grateful for the excuse. Part of her wanted to get this over and done with, but another more cowardly part was clutching at any straw to postpone the cataclysm that was sure to follow. Where's Harding?
In his room, I think. Having a nap is my guess. Why?
Oh, just wondered. The bathroom was on the first floor, just one for the entire house, with a huge claw-footed tub streaked green with copper rust, and a lavatory in one corner with a chain that clanked and screeched when Hal pulled it, reminding her of the metallic groan of the gates. But the water, when she turned the brass taps, was hot, and the pressure was good, and when she at last lowered herself into the scalding heat, she felt something inside her release, a tension that she hadn't known she was holding on to. "Uncle Harding, I'm not who you think I am."
"No, absurdly dramatic."
But how could she say it? How could she bring it up? "When I went back home, I discovered something."
And then the story of the diary, as though she had just come to this dawning realization.
The trouble with that was that it was a lie.
So what, then?
"Harding, Ezra, Abel, I set out to defraud you." Maybe the words would come when she faced them all. Closing her eyes, she submerged herself beneath the water so that her ears filled with the sound of her own pulse and the drip, drip of the tap, driving out all the other voices.
"Harriet!"
Hal jumped and turned, clutching the towel to herself as Harding's head came out of the doorway of one of the rooms. At the sight of her, damp and pink from the bath, bare shoulders rising from a swathe of towel, he looked almost as horrified as Hal felt.
"Oh, my dear, I'm so sorry."
"I had a bath," Hal said unnecessarily. She felt the corner of the towel slip and hitched it up, holding her damp clothes in front of herself like a shield. "I was just going up to get dressed."
Of course,"
Harding said, waving a hand to indicate that she should feel free to go, though when Hal turned, he spoke again, forcing her to turn back, shivering as she did in the sudden draught.
"Oh, Harriet, I'm so sorry. There was one thing I wanted to say before we met with the others. I won't keep you, but I wanted... Well, your offer to perform a deed of variation was very generous, but I'm sorry to say that Abel, Ezra, and I discussed it, and Ezra is being rather difficult about it. He's an executor, you know, and as such he has to agree to any such deed, and he feels rather strongly that Mother's wishes should be honoured, however perverse and disruptive. I must say it seems an extraordinary position to me, given he never showed the least interest in her wishes when she was alive, but, well, there it is. We'll discuss it with Mr. Trezick tomorrow, anyway."
Hal shivered again, unable to prevent it, and Harding seemed belatedly to realise the cold.
"Oh dear, I am sorry. I'm keeping you dripping in the corridor. Don't mind me. I'll see you downstairs for a gin and tonic, perhaps."
Hal nodded, stiff with the knowledge of all that she had left unspoken, and then, unable to think what else to say that was not an addition to all the lies she had already told, she turned and made her way up the stairs to the attic room. It was perhaps half an hour later when she pushed open the door to the drawing room and found all three brothers sitting inside, around the coffee table, in front of a roaring log fire. There was a bottle of whiskey on the table between them, and four tumblers, one unfilled.
"Harriet!"
Harding said, heartily. His face was flushed with a mix of heat and whiskey, Hal suspected.
"Come in and have a drink. I'm afraid my offer of gin and tonic turned out to be premature. There's no tonic in the house. But I did take the precaution of buying a bottle of whiskey when I was in Penzance earlier, so we do at least have that."
"Thanks," Hal said, "but I don't really..." She stopped. She didn't drink, not any more. There had been too many oblivious nights after her mother's death. Too many times when one glass had dissolved into many. But now she had a sudden, powerful yearning for something, however small, to nerve her for what she was about to do. "Actually, thanks," she said, and Harding poured her a generous, over-generous measure and pushed the tumbler across the table to her. He refilled his brother's glasses at the same time and then raised his own.
"A toast,"
he said, meeting Harriet's eyes.
"A toast to..."
He paused and then gave a little short laugh.
"To family."
Hal's stomach tightened, but she was saved from answering by Ezra's derisive snort. He shook his head.
"I'm not bloody drinking to that. To freedom."
Abel gave a chuckle and picked up his own tumbler.
"Freedom seems a little harsh. I'll drink to..."
He raised his glass, thinking.
"To closure. To seeing Mr. Trezick tomorrow and getting home to Edward ASAP. How?"
The acrid smell of the whiskey stung her nostrils, and she swirled it, looking down into the tawny, glinting depths. "I'll drink, too." Words crowded in, unsayable words. Truth. Lies. Secrets. Her throat tightened. There was only one toast that she could find in her heart, the crowding, painful truth waiting to be blurted out. "To my mother," she said huskily. There was a long pause. The whiskey in Hal's glass trembled as she looked around the circle of faces. Harding's moustache quivered as he raised his glass.
"To Maud,"
he said, his voice harsh with suppressed emotion. The whiskey caught the light, winking solemnly. Abel swallowed hard and raised his own tumbler.
"To Maud,"
he said very softly, his voice so low Hal would not have been sure of the word if she had not known what it was already. Ezra said nothing, but he raised his glass, and his dark eyes were bright with a grief Hal found almost too painful to look at. For a moment they sat, all four of them, glasses raised in silent remembrance, and then all of a sudden, Hal could bear it no longer. In one movement, she threw back her head and gulped the whiskey down in three long swallows. There was a short silence, and then Harding burst out with a kind of shakily relieved laughter, and Ezra clapped a slow round of applause.
"Well done, Harriet,"
Abel said dryly.
"I wouldn't have thought you had it in you, you little mouse."
There it was again. Little mousy Harriet. But it was not true. It had never been true. After her mother's death, she had made herself small and insignificant, but the facade that she showed to the world was not the truth of her. Inside, there was an iron strength. The same strength, Hal realized, that had enabled her mother to escape Trepassen, start again in a strange town, pregnant and alone, and build a life for her baby daughter. At the heart of her, beneath the unassuming layers and drab clothes, was a deep, resilient core that would keep fighting and fighting and fighting. Mice hid and scuttled. They froze in the face of danger. They allowed themselves to be made prey. Whatever Hal was, she was not a mouse. And she would not be anybody's prey. Uncle Harding, I'm not who you think I am. When she put the glass down, it rattled against the tray and she cleared her throat, her cheeks burning with the consciousness of what she was about to do. She remembered Mrs. Warren's look that first night, the look of someone watching a flock of pigeons who sees a cat suddenly creeping from the shadows of a nearby tree, the look of someone who stands back and waits.
"Well,"
Harding began, but Hal interrupted him, knowing that if she did not do this now, she might never do it.
"Wait, I have something to say."
Harding blinked, slightly put out, and the corner of Ezra's mouth quirked as if he were amused to see his brother discomforted.
"Oh, well, please,"
Harding waved a hand,
"be my guest."
Hal bit her lip. She had been turning this moment over and over in her mind ever since she left Cliff Cottages, but the right words had not come, and suddenly she knew it was because there were no right words. There was nothing she could say that would make this okay. "I have something to tell you," she said again. And then she stood up, not quite knowing why, but feeling unable to stay slack and safe in the corner of the sofa. She felt like she was about to fight, to defend herself from attack. The muscles in her neck and shoulders hurt with tension. "I found out something when I was back in Brighton. I hadn't been sure before, but I went through my mother's papers and I found out..." She swallowed, her mouth suddenly dry, wishing she had not drained the whiskey so fast, but had saved a sip for now. Harding was frowning. Abel was suddenly tense, leaning forward in his chair, his expression full of a kind of apprehension. Only Ezra looked unconcerned. He had folded his arms and was regarding her with interest, like someone watching an experiment play out.
"Well,"
Harding said with a little impatience in his voice,
"what did you find? Spit it out, Harriet."
"Margarita Westaway, your sister. She was not my mother," Hal said. She felt a great weight roll off her. But there was no relief in its passing, only an aching pain and a kind of dread as she waited for the crash as it dropped. There was a long silence.
"I... what?"
Harding said at last. He was staring at Hal, his plump, ruddy face scarlet with the heat of the fire, or with shock at Hal's speech, he was not sure which.
"I beg your pardon?"
"I'm not your niece," Hal said.
She swallowed again. There were tears coming up from somewhere deep inside, and it would have been so easy to let them out, play for their sympathy. But the knowledge made her force them back down. She would not play the victim here. She was done with dissembling.
"I should have realized before there were things. They didn't add up. But it was only when I went home, I looked in my mother's papers to try to get to the bottom of it, and I found diaries, letters, making it clear there had been a terrible mix-up. My mother wasn't your sister. She was Maggie."
"Oh my God."
It was Abel who spoke, his voice flat and blank with shock. He put his head in his hands as if to try to contain thoughts that threatened to burst out.
Oh, my God. Hal, but this is...
He stopped, shaking his head like someone punch drunk trying to shrug off blows.
Why didn't we see? But wait! This means the will is invalid!
Harding burst out.
For God's sake!
Ezra said. He gave a derisive laugh.
Money! Is that all you can think of? The will is hardly the most important thing. It's what brought Harriet here in the first place, so I would say it's quite important, yes.
Harding shot back.
And the money isn't the point at all. I deeply resent what you're implying there, Ezra. It's about... Oh, dear God, just when we were beginning to get the whole benighted situation sorted out, what in hell's name was Mother thinking?
A good question, Abel said in a low voice. He was slumped in his seat, his head still in his hands.
But your name was in the will, Harding said slowly.
He had the air of someone whose first shock was beginning to wear off, who was retracing their footsteps, trying to piece things together.
Or, wait, are you telling us? Are you not Harriet Westaway at all? Who are you really?
No, Hal said quickly. No, I am Harriet, I promise you. And my mother really is Margarita Westaway. But I think your mother must have asked Mr. Trezick to trace her daughter. Hal's face felt stiff and her fingers cold in spite of the fire. And somehow the threads became crossed and he found my mother instead without realizing the mix-up. I think he must have reported back to your mother that he had found your sister and that she had died, but that she had a daughter. And so she put my name in the will, not realizing that I wasn't her granddaughter at all.
How did you not realize? Abel said.
But there was no anger in his voice, only bewilderment. He looked up at Hal, his eyes full of a puzzled pain that she didn't fully understand.
Surely there were things that didn't add up, things that made you think...
He stopped. Hal felt herself grow still and careful. This was it. This was the dangerous part. Because he was right. She forced herself to stop pacing and to sit, and her mother's voice was in her head. When you're tempted to answer in a hurry, slow down. Make them wait for you. Give yourself time to think. It's when we hurry that we're most prone to stumble. Well, she said slowly. The sofa spring squeaked as she shifted her weight uncomfortably, and the wind howled in the chimney. Well, there were things. Not at first, but later. But you have to understand, my name, it was there in the will. And Mum never spoke much about her childhood. She never mentioned any brothers or a house in Cornwall. But then there was so much she never talked about. She didn't talk about her parents, either, or my father. I just took it for granted that this was another part of her I didn't know. And I wanted so much. Her voice faltered. No artifice here, as she fought hard against the tremor in her voice, for this was the truth. I wanted so much for it to be true. I wanted this, all of this. She waved her hand at the room, at the fire and the house, and the men sitting around her looking at her with varying degrees of puzzled exasperation and bewilderment. Family. Security. A home. I wanted it all so much. Mr. Trezick's letter felt like... It felt like an answer to a prayer. I think I shut my eyes to my doubts.
I can understand that,
Abel said heavily. He stood and rubbed his hands over his face, looking suddenly very old, much older than his 40-something years.
Dear God, what a mess.
At least you've told us now. Well, I for one will be having stern words with Mr. Tresick tomorrow,
Harding said. His face was a worrisome shade of purple.
This is damn close to some sort of professional negligence on his part. Lord knows how we'll sort out this legal tangle. Thank God it came out before we obtained probate.
Jesus, Ezra said under his breath. Can we stop banging on about the bloody will? Presumably you'll get the bloody money now, isn't that enough?
I resent,
Harding began more hotly, but he was interrupted by a tremendous resounding clanging that made everyone jump convulsively, and Harding slammed down his whiskey glass as the noise died away.
For God's sake, Mrs. Warren,
he bellowed, opening the drawing-room door.
We are all in here. Was there really any need for that?
She came to the door, hands on hips.
Dinner's ready.
Thank you,
Harding said rather ungraciously. He folded his arms and then looked at Abel, seeming to ask him an unspoken question. Hal couldn't quite read Harding's face, but Abel evidently understood, for he shrugged and nodded rather reluctantly.
Mrs. Warren,
Harding said heavily,
before we go into the dining room, there's something we should explain, as it concerns you too. It's come to light,
he shot a glance at Hal,
that Mr. Tresick made a rather unfortunate error in drawing up Mother's will. Harriet is not Maud's daughter. She is, in fact, Maggie's child, something Harriet only discovered when she went through her mother's papers. God knows how Mr. Tresick made such a regrettable error, but obviously, in light of it, the will is invalid. I'm not sure what will happen. I presume intestacy rules will have to be followed, but there it is.
I never thought she was,
Mrs. Warren said. She crossed her arms, a stick beneath her elbow. Harding blinked.
I beg your pardon?
Of course she's Maggie's child. No one with any sense would have thought otherwise.
What? But why didn't you say something?
Mrs. Warren smiled, and her eyes, in the dim light of the fire, seemed to Hal to glitter like stones.
Well?
Harding demanded again.
Are you saying you knew this for certain and you said nothing?
Not for certain, but it was common sense. And none of my business, anyway.
Well!
This time it was an explosion of disbelief. But Mrs. Warren had already turned and was stumping down the long tiled corridor, a cane clicking as she went.
Did you hear that?
Harding asked the silent group, but no one answered. At last Ezra turned and walked out, his shoulders hunched in mutinous silence. Abel shook his head and followed. Harding turned too, and Hal was left alone. Her hands were still trembling, and she paused for a minute, warming them in front of the fire, trying to get the feeling back into her numb fingertips. She was just about to leave when a piece of coal in the grate suddenly flared and spat, throwing out a flaming splinter onto the rug. Hal was about to stamp on it when she realized her feet were bare. She had taken off her soaked shoes at the door. Instead, she took up the poker and flicked the coal back towards the stone-flagged hearth, scratching out the last sparks with the tip. There was a smoking hole in the rug and a scorch in the board beneath, but nothing to be done about either, and looking down, Hal saw that it was not the first. There were three or four holes even larger, one where the fire had eaten quite a little way into the board. With a sigh, she put the fire guard in place and turned to leave, only to find Mrs. Warren standing in the doorway, barring the way. "Excuse me," Hal said, but Mrs. Warren didn't move, and for a brief moment, Hal had a fantastic notion that she was going to have to call for help, or escape out of the window again. But when she took a step towards the doorway, Mrs. Warren pressed herself back against the frame and allowed Hal to pass through, though she had to edge her way to avoid tripping on Mrs. Warren's cane. It was only when she was past and starting up the corridor, the tiles chill beneath her socked feet, that the woman spoke, her voice so low that Hal had to turn back. "What did you say?" Hal asked. But Mrs. Warren had disappeared inside the drawing room, and the heavy door slammed shut behind her, cutting Hal's words off short. But Hal was sure, at least almost sure, that she had caught the words, hissed low as they were beneath the sound of the wind in the chimney.
"Get out. If you know what's good for you, while you still can."
Chapter 38. Hal went to bed early that night, and whether it was the strain of the day or the long walk to Cliff Cottages, she fell asleep almost at once. She awoke stiff and with the sense of having slept a long time, but it was still not dawn, and when she got up and went to the window, shivering in the cold night air, the moon was still high. Her breath was white against the pane, and the sky had cleared, and in the moonlight she could make out the glitter of frost on the lawn. Her mouth was dry, and she reached for the glass beside her bed, but when she picked it up, it was empty. In her tiredness, she must have forgotten to fill it the night before. The chilly walk through the dark landing down to the bathroom below was not enticing, and Hal decided to ignore the thirst. She got back into bed and shut her eyes, but the dryness in her mouth niggled at her, keeping sleep at bay until at last she gave up, swung her legs out of bed, and picked up the glass. Wrapping her fleece around her, she went cautiously out into the corridor. It was pitch black, the lino freezing under her bare feet, and she tried the switch on the wall, but as she did, she remembered too late that she hadn't told anyone about the missing bulb. Sure enough, the switch clicked fruitlessly, and Hal sighed and went back to the attic room to pick up her phone. The thin tunnel of light from its torch made the corridor feel, if anything, even darker, but at least she could see the black yawning opening to the stairs. She was only one step down when her foot caught on something. Hal clutched instinctively for a banister, but there was none there. She felt her fingers scratch at the bare wall, and then the horrible, stomach-wrenching lurch as the phone flew from her hand and she realized she was falling, with nothing she could do to stop herself. She landed with a crunch in the hallway below, thudding her head against the floor, and rolled to a stop against the wall where she lay, gasping, winded, waiting for the sound of running footsteps, questions, solicitous inquiries. But none came. I'm okay, she called shakily. But there was no response. Only the noise of the wind, and beneath it, the far-off sound of a muffled snore coming from somewhere below. Cautiously, Hal sat up. She felt for her glasses before realizing she hadn't put them on in the first place. They were still on her bedside table, which was something at least to be thankful for. She'd almost rather have a broken arm than broken glasses so far from home. Her phone was on the bottom step of the stairs, face down, the torch still shining up to the ceiling, and when Hal picked it up, the screen was cracked, but the phone itself still seemed to be working.
The water glass, on the other hand, had smashed. There were shards scattered on the floor, and her hand was bleeding, but there was no blood coming from the place where her head had hit the floor, and when she flexed her arms, no bones seemed to be broken. As she got shakily to her feet, dizziness swept over her, but she didn't fall, only steadied herself against the wall, and it passed. It was almost unbelievable luck that she hadn't broken an arm or even her neck. The wall of the corridor was only feet away from the bottom of the stairs. If she had hit it with her skull, she would have been dead.
A wave of trembling sickness washed over her. Delayed shock, she thought, numbly, and she sank down onto the bottom step, feeling her head throb where she'd hit it against the floor, and the uncontrollable shaking in her arms and legs. She was no longer thirsty, and in any case the idea of picking her way through the shards of shattered glass in bare feet felt impossible. She wanted only to crawl back into bed where it was safe and warm, and let the trembling in her limbs subside. Slowly, she got to her hands and knees and, not quite trusting herself to go upright, she crawled up the stairs, her phone in her hand. In almost any other position, she might have missed it, but as it was, the light from the phone fell straight onto it. It was one step down from the top. A rusty nail, driven into the skirting board at ankle height, a length of snapped string still trailing from it. Hal felt her breath catch in her throat and she stopped, frozen, the beam from her phone shining onto the innocuous little thing. Then she got a hold of herself and forced herself to swing the beam to the other side of the stairs. There was its twin, driven into the same place, only this one had been wrenched almost out of place by the force of her fall. She hadn't tripped. This was no accident. Someone had driven in those nails and strung the string across the top step, taking advantage of the fused bulb at the top of the stairs to ensure that she wouldn't see, even in daylight, what had been done. It hadn't been there when she went up to bed, she was sure of it. She couldn't have passed up the stairs without tripping over it. Which meant that someone had come up here while she was sleeping, to set the trap. But no, she wasn't thinking clearly. They could not have hammered in the nails. She would have heard them. Which meant... it meant that this had been premeditated. The nails had been there all along, waiting for the removal of the bulb and the string to be set up. Someone had been intending this. They had prepared for her return back from Brighton, and they had guarded against it. Hal's heart seemed to slow inside her chest, a great stillness settling over her. She should have been panicking, but it was as though something had hold of her inside and was squeezing, squeezing. She crawled rather than walked the last few steps into the attic room and shut the door before subsiding with her back against the wooden panels. Her head was in her hands, and she was thinking, not for the first time, of the bolts on the outside and of the silent malevolence of the person who had come up those stairs just a few hours earlier and set a trap designed to kill. As she closed her eyes and pressed her forehead into her knees, an image floated into Hal's head unbidden. It was the Eight of Swords. A woman, blindfold, bound, surrounded by a prison of blades, and the ground at her feet blood red as though she were already bleeding from cuts that could never free her. The cards tell you nothing you don't already know. It was her mother's voice, steady in her ear. They have no power. Remember that. They can't reveal any secrets or dictate the future. All they can do is show you what you already know. Oh, but now she knew all right. The walls of the trap were closing around her, sharp enough to maim. Now she knew someone hated her enough to kill her. But why? Because it didn't make sense. A few hours before, she might have thought that it was an attempt by one of the brothers to regain their share of the inheritance they had thought was theirs, because Hal was, had been, the residuary legatee. If she died, her share of the money obeyed the laws of intestacy, which meant, in the absence of a husband, it would be divided between Mrs. Westaway's children. But now she had admitted the truth. Harding, Ezra, and Abel had nothing left to fear from her. The money would revert back to them, whatever happened to her. So why, then? Why now? Get out, if you know what's good for you.
Après moi, le déluge.
What did it mean? Hal's head, where she had hit it, felt ready to burst, and it throbbed until she thought she might cry out from the pain of it. Whatever she had done, whatever she had meant, Mrs. Westaway had started something with this legacy, and Hal was blindly following the sequence of events she had set off. Only, like the woman on the Eight of Swords, she was hedged about with dangers she could not even see. At last, almost blind with the throbbing pain that had begun to envelop her entire skull, Hal crawled into bed, letting her aching head rest slowly on the cool pillow, closing her eyes and pulling the blankets up to her chin as though they could protect her against the threats she felt crowding around. She was almost asleep when a name came to her, like a suggestion, whispered into an ear. Margarita. The word trickled slowly, like cool, dark water, through the recesses of Hal's skull. And in its wake, in spite of her tiredness, her mind began working, making connections. Hal had claimed that her mother was Margarita Westaway, the girl called Maud in her mother's diary. And because of that claim, certain facts had been taken for granted. The fact that Maud had run away from Cornwall, the fact that she had moved to Brighton and had a daughter, and the fact that she had died in a car crash just 3 years ago. But the truth was very different. The question was, how different? And how far would someone go to keep the true facts from coming out? One thing was certain. This was no longer about the money. For Hal had kissed goodbye to that with her confession. There was something deeper and stranger at stake here. Something that someone would kill to conceal. She should have been afraid, and part of her was. But deep down, in the core of herself, the secret, predatory self that she kept hidden and locked away, Hal knew. She would not run again. Someone had tried to scare her away once, and it had almost worked. But it would not work again. Now, she wanted answers. What had set her mother running so long ago? Why had she gone to such lengths to lie about her father? And what had happened to Maud? And most of all, what was this secret? the secret that lay at the heart of all this mystery, which someone was ready to kill to protect. Hal wanted answers to all those questions and more. And she was ready to fight. Chapter 39. There was no question of going back to sleep, and at last Hal could bear it no longer. Her phone on the bedside table said 5:05. Too early to get up, but she could not lie there in the darkness for 2 more hours. She sat up and reached for her glasses, the movement making the back of her head throb painfully. But at last she had them settled on her nose, and she fired up her phone, frowning at the little screen as she tried to work out what to search. Something had happened to Maud Westaway, something that someone in this house knew and did not want anyone to find out. Was it Mrs. Warren? Hal thought again of her face last night, of the wicked, gloating pleasure, and the bald admission that she had known all along of Hal's deception. Whatever it was, Hal thought, she would not put Mrs. Warren past knowing about it and keeping it secret for her own twisted reasons. But trying to work out who in the house was concealing something was a blind alley, because the truth was, everyone had something to hide. Hal knew that well from her tarot readings. Everyone had secrets, things that they did not want to reveal and would go to great, sometimes extraordinary lengths, to conceal. What she had to do was try to work out what the secrets were and what her own part in them was. Someone had been prepared to kill her to stop her revealing what she knew. And what was that? Hal rubbed her knuckles into her eyes, trying to think clearly. Because of her evidence, everyone had assumed Maud was dead, that much was clear. And they had assumed, too, that she had died in a car crash. So there were 2 possibilities. The first was that Maud was dead, but not in a car crash, and that someone wanted to cover up what had really happened to her. That was alarming enough, the idea that she might have stumbled on a potential murder. But the second possibility was in a way even more worrying, for the other possibility was that Maud was alive, but that someone in this house was hell-bent on concealing that fact. But why? Could it be the money again, the will? If the legacy to Hal failed, would the money revert back to the pot, or would it travel back up the line that would have inherited it back to Maud? Or was it something else that someone was trying to conceal, something Maud knew or could reveal? There was no way of knowing. But either way, the first step was finding out which possibility she was dealing with. Finding out whether someone was alive or dead was surprisingly hard. Hal knew that from a client who had come back time and time again, begging Hal to tell her whether her missing husband was still alive, in spite of Hal's increasingly emphatic insistence that she did not know. It was always the way. The people who were skeptics would never be convinced, and the people who believed would never be persuaded otherwise. Hal was used to that. Used to the resigned disbelief when she told people that she could not answer their questions or change the facts of their lives, as if she had powers she was concealing but chose not to admit for some perverse agenda of her own. She knew the source of their disbelief. It was a reluctance to come to terms with the fact that they would never get the answers and outcomes they craved. But most people, however unwillingly, accepted Hal would not change fate for them, even if they did not accept that she could not. They went away secretly believing that if Hal would not oblige, there would be others out there who would, if they only searched hard enough. This woman, however, had to be different. She had come back time and time again, phoning under different names when Hal stopped accepting appointments from her, turning up without warning and banging on the glass so that Hal learned to dread the clutch of her lean fingers and the desperation in her hollowed eyes. At last, more from a desire to be rid of her than any kind of charity, Hal had taken down the husband's name and last known address, and had herself turned to the internet to try to give the woman the answers she needed, only to run up against an almost complete lack of information. The man wasn't on Facebook, and it seemed impossible to search for a death certificate without knowing the date of death. Hal had assumed that the records would be computerized, and that a simple search of the man's name and perhaps his date of birth would throw up anything on record, but it seemed not. For historic records, such a facility existed, but for anything in the last 50 years, you needed to know the exact details of death, not just to obtain a death certificate, but simply to find out if such a certificate existed. It seemed that without knowing when someone had died, there was no way of finding out if they even had. But Hal had no date of death. If Maud was dead, her brothers knew nothing of the true facts of what had happened, and Mr. Tresick's searches had not uncovered the fact. The alternative, then, was to prove the opposite, that she was still alive. But how? The only lead Hal had was the Oxford College that Lizzie had mentioned. An unconditional offer from Oxford, she had said, and later that she thought it was a women's college. Hal opened up Google on her phone. In 1995, there had been only one women's college left in Oxford, St. Hilda's, though Somerville had only just become co-educational the year before. It was possible that Maud might have called it a women's college in her description to Lizzie. A few minutes searching threw up a database of alumni for both colleges, but it was searchable only by people who were themselves former members of the college. Oxford itself would confirm a candidate's degree and class to an employer, but took 21 days to respond to requests. Hal sighed, but wrote down the numbers of the colleges. Perhaps if she spoke to a real person, she could blag the information she needed. Or she could pretend to be Maud herself, and perhaps whether they spoke to her or not would tell her whether she was a former member of the college. Really, though, where did that get her? 2-3 years on from Maud's disappearance from Trepassen? It still left a huge gulf of years after that on which Hal had no information whatsoever. And out of the only people she could have asked, one had just tried to kill her. In the cold light of day, it was hard to realize and remember. Had it really happened? The bump on her head was clear enough, but the nails and the piece of string, had she really seen what she had thought? It was almost 7 now, and Hal stood, shivering as the covers fell away, and pulled on her clothes, cold as the floor they had been lying on. Outside in the hallway, she took a deep breath and switched on the torch on her mobile phone. The nails were still there, rusted and bent, one either side of the stairs, but the string had gone. Hal frowned. She was certain she remembered it. A piece of unremarkable garden twine, dark against the drab boards, fastened at one end around the left-hand nail. But it wasn't there anymore. Only a pale, loose thread from the lino on the landing trailed down. Had someone come up and cleared it away? Or was it possible she had mistaken the lino thread in the darkness? She switched off the torch and walked slowly and carefully down the stairs, watching her step for shards of the broken glass and thinking as she did. Last night, her one thought had been to show Harding, Abel and Ezra the evidence of what someone had tried to do. Now she was reconsidering. The nails were bent and rusted, and even to Hal's eye they looked as if they could have been there for some time.
And as for the string, she could just hear Harding's scepticism.
Really, Harriet? Isn't it possible you just caught your foot in that trailing thread from the lino? Regrettably careless, certainly, but hardly a plot to kill.
And the answer was, yes, it was possible. Though Hal was as certain as she could be that that was not what had happened. Downstairs, Hal stepped lightly off the carpeted flight of stairs onto the cold tiles of the entrance hall. As she did, a clock somewhere deep inside the house ground into action and began to strike. Hal counted off the chimes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. The silence afterwards was a little unnerving, but the feeling faded as she pushed open the drawing room door. It was empty, just as they had left it last night, the whiskey glasses scattered across the table. 4 cups. In tarot, the 4 of cups meant inwardness. It meant not noticing what was under your nose, failing to grasp the opportunities that were being presented. In Hal's deck, the card was a young woman lying under a tree, apparently asleep or meditating. 3 empty cups lay on the ground in front of her, and a 4th was being offered to her lips by a disembodied hand. But the woman didn't drink. She didn't even notice what was being shown to her. What was it that she was failing to notice? Breakfast would not be served until 8, and Hal didn't relish the thought of bumping into Mrs. Warren as she had the first morning, so she pushed her feet into her shoes, still damp from their soaking yesterday, put up the hood of her fleece, and gently undid the drawing-room window, stepping outside into the chilly dawn air. The night had been clear and very cold, and the temperature overnight had gone well below freezing. The grass beneath Hal's feet was thick with frost, and it crunched gently as she walked, her breath a cloud of white, tinged with the faintest of pink by the rising sun. Outside, in the cold, bracing air, her panicked certainty of last night had begun to recede, leaving her feeling a little foolish. A blown light bulb, which someone had got halfway through replacing and then forgotten, a couple of nails, probably left over from when a carpet runner had covered the stairs, and a single thread, both seen by the wavering light of a mobile phone. It wasn't much to build a conspiracy theory on. And besides, it didn't make sense. Even if Maud was dead, and even if someone wanted to prevent that fact from coming out, what would be the sense in trying to kill her? She had already revealed the truth, that her mother wasn't Maud. There was nothing left to disclose. Tripping her down the stairs would be a pointless risk and achieve nothing. The horse had bolted, and there was no stable door to close. In the slowly brightening dawn, her fears of the night before suddenly seemed not just laughable, but impossible, and she felt her cheeks flush a little as she remembered her panicked crawl back to her room and the thumping of her heart as she sat against the door with her knees to her chest. "Oh, Hal," her mother's voice in her ear. "Always so dramatic." She shook her head. She had been walking aimlessly, letting her feet take her where they wanted. And now, as she looked back over her shoulder to the house, she realized quite how far she had come. For a moment she stood, looking back at the green sea of lawn between herself and the house, and beyond that, the tangle of stables and outbuildings, glass houses and kitchen plots. How many homes could you build in this one garden? How many people could you house, and how many jobs could you create? And here it all was, all this land, all this beauty, ring-fenced, first for one dying old woman, and now for her heirs. Well, it was no longer her problem. Ezra Harding and Abel could fight over it now. What would they do? Sell it? Perhaps it would become a hotel, with the grounds given over to swimming pools and glamping yurts. Or perhaps someone would knock the house down and build a golf course with rolling green as far as the eye could see, a grass-green sea meeting the blue of the horizon. Today, the far-off sea was grey, tipped with white horses, and the wind was fresh in Hal's face as she walked, always downhill. She had been planning to get as far as the boundary and then cut back round to the house, but when she looked away from the headland, she realised that her feet had led her inexorably back to the path they always seemed to take. The clump of trees, with the dark water glimmering through. This time, however, Hal looked at the water with different eyes. It was not just any lake that lay within the dense, overgrown copse. It was the lake, the one her mother had written about in her diary. And there, between the bare, frosted trunks, she could see the shape of the boathouse. She changed direction.